I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Today, we thought we'd take you on a little trip with us.
Well, it appears that everybody's ready. And into the spacious luggage compartment with the bags.
This 1940s commercial for Chevrolet will give you a sense of where we are. That's right, we're in Detroit. We continue to return to Detroit because it's one of the places that helped transform American life. It was a place where people from all different races and backgrounds could earn a good paycheck, buy their own homes and cars. Large-scale manufacturing, union power, a strong middle class, and the music that became the soundtrack for American life all can claim roots in Motown. Martha Reeves and the Vandellas were just one of the many successful acts that took the Motown sound to a national audience. And yet, in the latter part of the 20th century, Detroit, like many American cities, would see its share of challenges, bringing a grittier soundtrack to the city, like the rapper Eminem. Still, in his State of the Union address last week, President Obama talked about the Renaissance city as an inspiration for the rest of the country to jumpstart American manufacturing.
What's happening in Detroit can happen in other industries. It can happen in Cleveland and Pittsburgh and Raleigh.
Later in the special broadcast from Detroit, we will speak with Dan Gilbert. You might know him as the founder and CEO of Quicken Loans, the country's largest online home lender, or you might know him as the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. But what you might not know is that he has invested tens of millions of dollars in downtown Detroit, and we will find out why in a few minutes. But we begin the program today with the mayor of Detroit, Dave Bing. He's a former basketball star and a successful businessman who's made it his mission to try to lead the city's revival. To do that, he has to confront the challenges that Detroit continues to face, including a massive financial crisis that could lead to a state takeover if the economic situation in the Motor City does not stabilize soon. So we're pleased to start the program today with the mayor of Detroit, Dave Bing. And we are both here in member station WDET in Detroit. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you. My pleasure being here.
You know, obviously, we want to talk to you about your vision, but we do have to face the critical issues the city is facing now. I mean, the headlines are dire. The cuts that are being proposed by you, by the city council, are draconian by any measure. You know, firing thousands of employees. You're in the middle of negotiating, you know, givebacks or trying to get givebacks from city unions. I just want to ask you, just before we start, what do you think the mood of the city is right now?
Well, I think there's a reality that's finally set in. I think for so long, people thought things were always going to be as they were. And as we get into the financial straits that we're in today, and you constantly tell people we must change, we can't continue like we did in the past, you know, people didn't believe it initially. They had been lied to, I think. And now that you're telling them the truth, you have to do it over and over again. And so when we tell people you have to change, people wouldn't constantly say, well, I agree with you, there needs to be change, but I don't want to be impacted by the change.
This may be a question that might seem ridiculous here, but I think it is a question that perhaps other people are asking, that there are other cities in Michigan who are under emergency management. Their finances are essentially being run by the state. And I think the question some people might ask is, what's so terrible about that?
Well, I think we are a home rule city. And we, as elected officials, were elected by our population to manage the city. And when you take that away, and that has happened to us on two different occasions, not so much with city government, but within our school system. And our school system has been under emergency managers for the last 3 years, almost 4 years now. And a lot of people don't feel that that's the democratic process working as it should work.
What impact, though, have you seen in the schools by having the schools under emergency management? That's kind of your focus group for now.
Well, what I think it's done, it's elevated a lot of the inefficiencies. And there are changes that are happening. They're moving slow. But there's always a negative impact on people. And what we don't realize is that whether it's the education system or municipal government, we're not job creators. And too many people look at the school system and city government as a place of employment. And we are way, way too heavy on the employment side, and we've been that way for a long time. And all of a sudden, we find ourselves in a situation where we have to cut, and you're cutting a lot of people, and it really has a negative impact on the person and his or her family. But it's something that has to happen. Otherwise, you go out of business.
We are speaking with the mayor of Detroit, Dave Bing. He's joined us here at WDET for our special broadcast from Detroit. You know, on the plus side, President Obama has been praising Detroit to the skies during his State of the Union speech recently. He's been talking about the turnaround in the auto industry, that GM has regained its place as the top auto seller in the world, and he says that other industries can be revived. Are you feeling any of that here? Is any of that helping the situation of the city?
It's not helping in the city itself right now. General Motors, as one of our largest employers in the city, Chrysler also is here. A lot of their plants are not in the city. They are around the state of Michigan or in the Midwest. So from a Detroit perspective, outside of headquarters being here, we don't see and are benefiting from the resurgence in the automotive industry. But I want to say emphatically that if the president had not done what he did in support of both Chrysler and General Motors, our country would have lost millions of jobs. And, you know, the technology in that particular industry allows us to put our foot in a lot of the different industries around the globe.
Well, what would make a difference for Detroit?
Well, the greatest thing that could happen for us would be job creation. And I think my job is to not create jobs, but to create the environment for jobs. And I think that's what Dan Gilbert is just a great asset to our city. He's come downtown. He's looked at old buildings that he's been able to refurbish. He's made some, I think, some very masterful moves in terms of not only his commitment to the city, but bringing, along with the buildings that he's buying and renovating, he's bringing business back to downtown. And so a big problem that he's presenting for me, which is a good problem, is making sure I've got affordable housing for a lot of the people that are now working downtown. And I hope that he continue to do what he's doing, because in the end, it will definitely help our city.
Well, I understand that you're in the thick of it, as we said, that you are in the middle of trying to stabilize Detroit's finances, trying to stave off a state takeover. But I did want to ask if you think that there is something that other cities can learn from some of the things that you've gone through here and are going through now.
Well, I think the first thing you've got to do is be transparent. You've got to tell people the truth, as bad as it may be. And when I came into office, I came into office with a $330 million accumulated deficit over time. So I had a financial crisis day one when I walked into the office. And so trying to let people know how dire the situation is, because most people look back and say, you know, I remember the good old times. Well, the good old times are the good old times. They're not coming back. We've got to do something altogether different. So we've got to, I think, make a total transformation in terms of what our city was, in terms of where we wanted to go. And so we can't be as dependent on the one industry that we were so dependent upon. So now we're being much more open to other industries coming in, being supportive. We've got some areas where there is growth. But the reality is this. The Midwest, Michigan and Detroit in particular, are still going to be very dependent upon the automotive industry. But there are a lot of industries that are dependent on this industry, and we've got to start, I think, making sure we get into those industries.
If you and I were to get together 5 years from now, but I hope it'll be sooner than that, but if we were to get together 5 years from now and talk about the city, what will we be talking about? What kind of conversation are we going to be having?
We would talk about how the city has come back. You know, nobody thought that General Motors or Chrysler, two of the largest corporations on the globe, would go bankrupt. They did. And they changed. They transformed themselves. And in a very short period of time, they came out of bankruptcy, and now they are profitable companies that are starting to grow again. That's the way Detroit's going to be. We have to look at ourselves a little differently. We're not New York. We're not L.A. We're not Chicago. But we are Detroit. And we've got to understand, I think, what our strengths are. And we've got to build upon our strengths. We can't be something that we are not prepared to be. So I think our downtown is leading the way. Midtown is coming back very strong. But what's been missing over the last several administrations and the last several years is the investment into the neighborhoods where our people live. So we've lost a lot of our population. Our population has moved to the suburbs, and we've got all of this vacancy, both in terms of housing and in terms of land. And so we've got to make some hard decisions once again on making sure that the people who are here, we have to give them the kind of respect. We have to give them the kind of services that they pay for. And it's my job to get that started.
And very, very briefly, if you would, you know, there was a time when if you said Detroit, you'd think cars, you'd think Motown. If you and I get together 5, 10 years from now and I say Detroit, what word is going to come to mind?
You still, I don't think we're going to get away from that. Those are still our roots. We've still got an unbelievable amount of talent in the automotive world. We've still got an unbelievable amount of talent in the music world. And so from a culture standpoint, it's no longer the Motown sound, but it's a lot of gritty stuff that's out there right now. And we have to accept that because the talent is here.
The Detroit sound.
Absolutely.
Will that do it for you?
That will
the
do
Detroit
it.
Sound.
That
okay.
will do it.
Dave Bing is the mayor of Detroit. He was kind enough to join us here in studio at WDET in Detroit. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And as we mentioned, businessman Dan Gilbert owns the Cleveland Cavaliers basketball team, but he's also a Detroit native who's investing heavily in his hometown to try to make it a winner once again. We will hear from him. Just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News, I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are in Detroit today, and we are talking about the city's past, present, and hopes for the future. You might remember that President Obama has been praising Detroit, especially the auto industry, for its turnaround. In a few minutes, we'll talk about one of the difficult decisions that officials believe contributed to that turnaround, the agreement between the automakers and the auto workers union to drastically cut wages for new hires. So now the industry is hiring again. New people are doing the same work as veterans for half the pay. We'll find out how that's working out in a few minutes. But first, we have a visit with a man who has bet heavily on a continued turnaround for Detroit. Dan Gilbert is probably best known nationally as the majority owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, the NBA team, and he is the founder and chair of Quicken Loans. That's one of America's largest retail home lenders. But what you might not know is that the company moved its headquarters to downtown Detroit 2 years ago. At a time when many people are leaving the city, Mr. Gilbert has doubled down. He's bought some of the city's most significant structures, including, most recently, the historic Federal Reserve Building, making him one of Detroit's biggest landlords. The goal is to revive Detroit as a center for technological innovation and entrepreneurship. And Dan Gilbert is with us now from his office in Detroit to talk about all this. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit more about your vision for the city? And I might mention that in addition to the buildings you've been buying, you've been pushing for a light rail public transit system. What's your vision?
Well, we'd like to see Detroit be one of the primary technology web center development places in the whole United States, where there's a vibrant community of young people and old people alike who are living, working, and playing right in downtown. And there's a lot of jobs, a lot of entrepreneurial activity, and a lot of venture capital, and just a lot of excitement in general.
Now, you are from here, so I do have to ask, is this a project of the head or of the heart?
We call it doing well by doing good, so there's both parts there, and you know, we think there's no conflict in that. We think there's a huge opportunity for investment for sure, but also that we can affect the outcome. We can actually affect the change. And with the automobile recovery, as you just mentioned, we think that there's an opportunity on both sides of that fence of doing great for our community at the same time profiting as well.
You know, from the outside, and you see, you know, what the headlines are talking about, you know, parts of Detroit looking like a ghost town, people still leaving the city, wages are still depressed because of all the problems that we know so much about. What is it that gives you confidence that this investment is a sound one?
Well, you know, it's we're fortunate enough to be involved in several companies, Quicken Loans being the flagship of that, where we can affect the outcome by our people themselves moving downtown, working downtown, and some of them moving downtown. And so it's a little bit different than just sort of investing and watching and seeing what happens, but actually investing and affecting the change by taking other action. And our people are very, very excited about it. They're charged up about it. And there's something special going on here.
One of the things that the president has talked about, and not just the president, but other leaders with different political perspectives, is the skills gap. They've talked about the fact that there are jobs available, but often there are not workers available who have the skills to fit those jobs. And I'm interested to know if you are finding that.
Yeah, we look at that a little differently. We actually look at there's a brain drain in Michigan and Detroit, and we're trying to turn it around into a brain gain. In other words, a lot of great, talented people coming out of the universities of Michigan and Michigan State and Wayne State, Eastern, and a lot of other universities in the area. And a lot of them, the best and brightest, are leaving the area. And what we found that they want to be in a central city. They want to be in the places that offer jobs and excitement and activity and retail and place to live. What we've done is try to work with others to recreate that attraction in downtown Detroit, and we're working to make that happen so we can keep them here. They're the ones that are going to create the wealth of the future and the jobs of the future.
How do you know that you're not rearranging the deck chairs? How will you know? What will be your metric to determine whether you are really, in fact, sort of adding value and creating new opportunities as opposed to just moving them from place to place, if you see what I'm asking?
Well, most of our activity centers around start up new businesses, new companies. So those companies are started from scratch, creating new jobs, new wealth. And, you know, ourselves as well, again, the flagship Quicken Loans, it would have been very difficult from where we were in the suburbs to be in a lot of different buildings that were far apart from each other as we were. Having our people work together and being close to each other and being able to walk over and see each other, whether they're in the same building or a different floor or even a building right next to each other, is a major advantage for us at getting things done and being collaborative. So some of these things you can measure by how many new positions are created and added, and others are sort of more qualitative, and you've got to just look at it by observation and realize and know you're making an impact.
Is there something that you think other cities who are also struggling or at least trying to kind of regain the spark, is there anything that you think that they can learn from your experience here, from Detroit, or are the circumstances here just so distinct that it really doesn't apply anywhere else?
Well, I think connectivity is the name of the game. I mean, whether it's the internet connecting everybody in the world or whether it's people wanting to be in an urban downtown where there's collaboration and connectivity physically, that goes again with having, you know, great mass transit downtown where people are moving very quickly and easily. But being able to have people connect in all kinds of ways is critical as the economy moves forward into the brain economy and the wealth-producing economy based on ideas, innovation, collaboration, and all that. So when you're a city, you know, to be spread out physically is just not the best way to create jobs, create startups, create action, create activity. And also the young folks coming out of school or in their second job or third job or whatever it may be, that's what they want. Overwhelmingly, that's what they want. So my advice to cities as well as businesses is to become part of that and embrace that.
So finally, how do your folks in Cleveland feel about all the time you're spending in Detroit? Do they feel jealous, like they feel like you're, you know, cheating on them? How do they feel about it?
I don't think so. You know, I was born and raised in Detroit, and I think we've shown in Cleveland a major commitment. We consider it our sister city. And they're very similar types of challenges in both cities, and you know, we're very active and invested in there. Hopefully they understand.
So you have enough love for both places?
We have a lot of love for both of them. We call ourselves, we're very Lake Erie-centric.
Okay. Dan Gilbert is the founder and chairman of Quicken Loans. He's the majority owner of the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers. He's become a major investor in downtown Detroit real estate and has moved the headquarters of Quicken Loans there, and he joined us from his office in Detroit. Dan Gilbert, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And now we turn to the industry that has driven Detroit's ups and downs, the auto industry. Like the city itself, the big three car companies, GM, Chrysler, and Ford, have gone through their own hard times. Back in 2008, we heard this from then-Chrysler CEO Bob Nardelli. This was in a hearing before a congressional committee.
Chrysler is requesting a $7 billion loan to bridge the current financial crisis. And in exchange, Chrysler is committed to continue our restructuring.
That was then. In 2011, the Big Three reported market share increases for the first time in decades, and American automakers posted a 10% increase in sales. Part of the restructuring Nardelli talked about was a controversial industry contract with the United Auto Workers that drastically cut wages and benefits for all new hires, essentially creating a two-tier wage system for the Big Three. We wanted to know more about how this is working out, so we've called upon the Detroit Free Press's Brent Snavely. He reports on the auto industry. Also with us is the president of UAW's Local 845, Allison Hugg. She took a buyout when Ford was in crisis, but she was later hired back to the same plant as an entry-level employee. And they're both here with us, and we got in touch with her through the UAW. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for having given us the opportunity to be on the air.
So, Brent, let me start with you, because I think that most people can understand why the automakers would want to pay lower wages. Why did the auto union, why did the UAW agree?
Well, if we go back to 2007, which is just 1 year before that tape that you played with Bob Nardelli there, back in 2007, the Detroit Three had been losing market share for many, many years. Their labor costs had been increasing, and the UAW recognized that it needed to accept drastic actions in order to make the UAW competitive. And they really turned their attention to looking long-term into the future so that they could gain jobs in the future so that both the UAW and the automakers could survive, and they realized that they needed to be partners in that future.
Allison, do you remember the debate over that? You were working at a Ford parts plant when these changes started. Do you remember any debate over that? Did you ever think it would have anything to do with you?
Not that it would have anything to do with me. We had to make the decisions and keep the auto companies viable, and we did what we had to do.
So as I recall your situation, you were working for a Ford parts plant when the changes started, and at the time, you decided for various reasons to take a buyout, but then your plans that for the buyout period didn't pan out. You wanted to start a business that didn't work as you had hoped.
Right.
So then, after 2 months, you were hired back to the same plant, this time under new ownership. As I understand it, you're making half the wage, $14 an hour, for doing the same work that you had done at $28 an hour. Is that right?
At this time, I make $16.50. So at the time I hired back in, yeah, I was making $14. But over the years, I've increased.
But not back to where you were. Can I just ask how that makes you feel when you do the work? Are you like irritated when you get your check, or what do you look at it and think, what?
No, I did what I did, and I knew what I was coming back to, and that was my personal decision when I went out.
What about the relationships within the plant? Do people know who's making what?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's like anywhere you get hired. When I hired in 94, I was making less than the Ford employee that was next to me, so it's a progression.
We're talking about the auto industry's two-tier wage system with Allison Hugg. She works in a parts plant near Detroit, and also Brent Snavely of the Detroit Free Press. He reports on this. You know, Brent, we caught up with a Ford employee who makes the higher-tier wage. He's part of a group that is vocally opposed to it. It's called the Auto Workers Caravan, and we were able to grab a quote from him about his take on what the new system says about the company. I'll just play it for you.
Their model was, if you work for Ford, you should be able to buy their product. But when you're cutting wages like you are now, it makes it hard to purchase products with the increase in the cost of living. So it's hard to have one person raise a family on just a two-tier wage. It just almost can't be done.
That was Eric Truss. So, Brent, to your knowledge, does that represent the attitudes of most of the people that you talk about?
I don't know if it represents the attitudes of many that I talk with. And one of the things that happens to me as a reporter is that by default I get phone calls from the loudest, angriest, most active folks. So it does represent a significant segment, but there are others that are perfectly happy with the entry-level wage. And one of the things I want to sort of back up and underline is you know, recognize that in 2007, the deal, as you accurately described it, was new hires would be hired at the lower tier wage. They didn't exist in 2007, and then we went through a recession for a couple of years, and very few new hires were hired at that wage for a couple of years. So this was a major controversy within the UAW for a long time, but it continues to bubble up and become a current controversy now, because now is when the Detroit Theater are actually growing and hiring people at that wage.
One of the things, Allison, that is you can't help but notice is that when they are hiring, thousands of people apply for the positions that are available. And I'm wondering if that's kind of in your mind. I mean, I know you were rehired in part because of the work that you had done previously, your attendance and so forth and your skill, you know, obviously. But is that part of your mind when you're thinking about the fact that you accepted a lower wage?
So. No, because I know there's progression and we all have to start here and build our way up. And we're not going to stay entry-level employees. There's that chance and opportunity to get to the Tier 1 Ford again.
Sometimes, does anybody ever think you shouldn't have accepted that wage? Does anybody ever say, oh, you shouldn't have done it, you should have held out, or we should have held out? Does that feeling still exist?
I mean, that came with the negotiating and everything that comes at a higher level. So I signed to do what I did. And
do you feel comfortable with your decision?
Yes.
You feel okay with it?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What is your sense of the feelings among the people that you work with? Do you feel that most people are pretty comfortable with it? Even if they don't like it, they can accept it?
They can accept it.
Now, I understand that the 2011 contract raised wages for entry-level employees you've been talking about, that it also provided for more profit sharing and improved on health care benefits. Are you feeling that? Are you seeing that?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, they've gained so much in this last contract, the paid vacation, paid personal time, bereavement, jury duty, co-pays for office visits, things that they didn't have. So
you feel like you're making progress.
Absolutely, making progress.
Brent Snavely, what about you? I just want to get your perspective on that. Is there a sense kind of in the industry that things are getting better?
Oh, absolutely. We've now had 2 years in a row where the U.S. auto sales have increased about 10% in 2010, an additional 10% in 2011, and forecasts are for about an 8% increase this year. And along with that, the Detroit 3 gained market share, a small amount, but they gained market share, as you said earlier, because they, for a lot of reasons, but one reason is that they've improved their products. And so there is a tremendous amount of hope and optimism for in a better future.
And I'm going to put you on the spot here and ask you the same question that I asked the mayor earlier, which is there a sense that the progress that the automakers are making, that the industry is making, is that, I don't like the term trickling down, but I'll use it, can't think of a better one, is that it's improving the city, the area, this community? Are people feeling it in the community?
I would say no, not yet, but I think it will. And to your point about, I mean, this was stunning to me. Chrysler recently announced that it would hire 1,100 additional workers at a plant in Detroit early next year, but they made the announcement recently. So my phone lines get flooded with calls from unemployed people when I write that story. Chrysler tells me they already have 10,000 job applications on file for those jobs before they announced that they would do the additional hiring. So the level of unemployment in Michigan and in Detroit and in this nation has not recovered, and it's not going to recover, best case scenario, for another 10 years to the point level that it was at in 1999. Things will get better, but you would need to see such a level of improvement to get back to where things were just 10 years ago that and it's almost impossible to see that coming. But yes, things will get better, just not back to 1999.
Allison, really briefly, do you think your life is getting better?
My life is good.
Okay. Glad to hear. Well, you look good.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Allison Hugg is the president of UAW's Local 845. She's actually experienced the two-tier wage system on both sides. She was here with us at member station WDET in Detroit for the special broadcast from Detroit. Also with us, Brent Snavely. He covers the auto industry for the Detroit Free Press. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Please stay with us. In a minute, we'll go to our moms for their take on teaching tolerance in school and at home. Joining us will be one of the moms profiled in the All-American Muslim series. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Please stay with us. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we will close out this special broadcast from Detroit with the thoughts of listeners who call the city home, from the art to the architecture. We'll hear what they want you to know about their city. That's in just a few minutes. But first, our moms are with us. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, we want to talk about something that nearly every parent struggles with, how to raise children to be tolerant and accepting in a diverse world, but a world that doesn't always celebrate or accept differences. And we thought that this was a good time and a good place to talk about this because Detroit has been a place where people from all over the country and indeed the world have come to seek a better life. But those differences aren't always easy. And we're also becoming more aware of the problem of bullying. Around 1 in 6 children is regularly bullied in school, according to a 2010 survey by Clemson University. And we're finding out that it can have real consequences. Thousands of students miss school every year because of bullying. And we wanted to talk more about how parents can teach their children about difference and how to handle people who perhaps aren't tolerant of those differences. So we've called together some parents. Desiree Cooper writes the blog Detroit Snob. She's a contributor to member station WDET. She's the mom of 2. Also with us in Detroit, Angela Jaffer. She's a mom of 4. And you might remember that name because her family was one of those profiled in TLC's reality show All American Muslim. And holding it down in Washington, D.C. is one of our regulars, Leslie Morgan Steiner. She is the mom of 3. She's also author of the books Mommy Wars and Crazy Love. Ladies, moms, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Always a pleasure, Michelle.
Angela, I've got to start with you just because I wanted to ask about the experience of being part of All American Muslim. It was profiling a number of families, Dearborn, Michigan, but no, yes. Close, to try to expose people to, as the title said, all-American Muslim families. I wanted to ask what kind of experience that was for you.
The experience as a whole was an incredibly wonderful experience. It was something that I'm glad my children and my husband and I had a chance to be a part of. Initially, when we were approached, we had our reservations because I honestly really didn't understand what the interest was. I guess from being in such a diverse area and such a heavily populated Muslim community in the Dearborn area, maybe you tend to not realize and understand that the rest of the nation may not have that perspective that you have. So hindsight being 2020, I think it was a wonderful reason to air such a topic because it started dialogue and it really raised a lot of questions and answers for people.
No, but I want to pick back on something that you said. At first, you didn't see what the big deal was.
No, I really didn't understand what the interest was. I honestly thought to myself, okay.
You just don't talk a lot about being Muslim. You don't talk a lot about being of, you know,
no, as
descent.
A matter of fact, the interesting part is most of my colleagues said, you're not Muslim. that was fun.
Well, it's interesting. Have you ever heard them say things that perhaps they would not have said if they had known that you were Muslim?
Not necessarily, no. I think I brace people as individuals and as human beings, and I think people treat you the way you expect to be treated. So
what about the kids?
My kids were completely unsure as to what the interest was as well, because it's not something that we discuss at home as far as the difference. We are Muslim, and that's what we raise our children as, but that doesn't mean that we highlight the differences. We try to highlight a lot of the similarities as human beings.
I do want to just mention, though, you don't wear a headscarf.
Right.
And I assume your girls don't either.
No, they
wear
do
a
not.
Headscarf. And I wonder if you think that would make a difference if you did.
I think if you do wear a headscarf, it does make a difference because you wear it more on your sleeve and people probably can label you and that stereotype might be more exposed to the stereotype when you wear a hijab. My daughters and I do not. So, yes, I think that was part of the reason why a lot of people that that knew us, colleagues, neighbors, friends, thought, oh, we never knew you were Muslim.
Well, talk about wearing it on your sleeve, Desiree. Mm-hmm. Your kids are now adults. Your daughter's 21 and your son is 24. But race is something that some people can not disclose, but generally race is literally something that you're kind of wearing on your face. And I just wanted to ask you about when your kids were growing up, one of the experiences that you had was that your daughter changed schools from one in which it was a majority black school, and then she switched to a majority white one. And I just wanted to ask about that experience and how you managed it with her.
It was, in a word, devastating. I was a little shocked by that because I'm a military brat, and I was raised quite often in an environment where I was the only black child, or my family was the only black family. And so I had that experience as a child of being the only black child in a classroom and how isolating and all that could be. So to come to Detroit and end up with my child, my daughter, having the exact same experience I had like 30 years before, and really reliving almost a trauma that it can be. You know, you, like Angela was saying, you teach your children it's other people's problems if they don't like you, and you're a wonderful human being, and you brace them and you send them out in the world, and then you get out in the world and they really are not treated as equal. Well, what does that do to a child's psychology?
Well, give an example if you wouldn't mind.
The ever-present birthday party, you know, and is your child going to get invited to the party? I felt that my daughter was a fourth grader at the time, around 10 years old. This is when girls are sending boys notes. It was very clear that she did not have permission to have a crush on a white boy in the classroom, that all the popular girls could have dates, but she was relegated, and I say relegated not in terms of a hierarchy, but in terms of her choice, to the other children of color, boys of color.
Well, how do you know this was race, though, not because she was new? I mean, that whole thing about the popular girl squeezing out the new girl is kind of is such a trope that, you know, there are all kinds of
exactly.
movies made about it, and
except
everybody's
that there
white.
No boy that was acceptable for her except the other boys of color, and they weren't even in her class. So, you know, it was an issue of she couldn't fit into that, and she really couldn't compete on that level, and it felt like she was less than, like she wasn't good enough, not only to be their friends, but also to sort of have, love interest in that group. She had to shop somewhere else.
I want to hear how you helped her cope with that. But before we do, I do want to bring Leslie into the conversation. Leslie, back in Washington, holding it down, as we said. Leslie, I want to pick up on something that Angela said. She said, we don't really talk about it that much. In terms of the research, that's actually quite common, mainly among, and I know you, I don't know how you describe yourself as, but among, I'll just say for the sake of conversation, white parents in this country often don't talk about race, whereas black parents often feel that they have to, and there's a lot of research that bears that out. So, Leslie, I want to ask you about that. Do you feel you need to talk to your kids about race, about ethnicity, about difference?
I do feel that I need to, but I think you're picking up on something that I see all the time, and I grew up with myself. You can't see me because I'm on the radio, but I'm white, and if there is such a thing, I'm very white because I don't know. I have blonde hair. I come from a really WASPy East Coast family. Half my relatives went to Harvard, blah, blah, blah. And I think if you're in the majority race, you don't feel the need to talk about it. And also, you feel like by not talking about it, you're somehow being very virtuous and being colorblind and saying that race doesn't matter. And the truth is, because I'm white, I have no idea whether race matters. You know, I'm never going to really understand what it's like to walk down the street as somebody who's African American or Hispanic or anything else that's not a majority race here in this country. So I have to work to talk about it. And I grew up in a family where we didn't talk about it. And I remember in the 70s, I was in a D.C. public school, and our school was integrated by the District of Columbia's busing program. And I had a new best friend who was black, and, you know, we were in love the way second-grade girls are. And I wish my parents had talked to me more about what the goal was of the busing program and why I couldn't go to Valerie's house. You know, I didn't even know where she lived. You know, it was so far away. And I think it was a real teachable moment that my parents, probably because they thought they were doing the right thing, didn't talk to me about. And when I have moments like that with my kids, I try to really talk to them about it. Because when you're white, I think there are very few opportunities to confront issues of racism. And as a parent, I've got to grab them.
Desiree, let's pick back up on that with you. Talk about that. How did you deal with that with your daughter? And I also want to ask the flip side of the question, because there are some who think that black parents talk about it too much.
Right, right.
That they load their kids' heads up with this idea that there's going to be a problem, and even when there isn't necessarily one.
Right. Well, my kids actually started in elementary school in a school that taught psychology of the norm. And so you don't talk about difference. You talk about similarities, and you don't assume, as Angela said, that every mean person hate you because you're Muslim or because you're black or because you're Asian. You know, you just might not be a good person. And so they weren't taught those judgments. What I feel is difficult is when you take that perfect, pretty little world and that nice psychology, and you put them in motion in real life, and, you know, honestly, you can do your kids a disservice because they're not prepared for the straight-up bias prejudices that people really do display. And I think that by talking to your kids, you can sort of help them not prepare, not expect, but to understand that it's not about them. And I know that Angela in particular, she's talked a lot about it's not about you if other people have issues with you. It's about their psychology.
We're having a regular visit with the moms from our special broadcast in Detroit, and I'm joined by Desiree Cooper. She's a freelance journalist and contributor to NPR member station WDET in Detroit. We're at WDET right now. Also with us, Angela Jafer. She is a Michigan mom. Her family was one of those featured on the TLC show All American Muslim. With us from Washington, D.C., one of our regulars, Leslie Morgan Steiner. And she's also a writer. She's also a mom of three. Angela, you wanted to say something about talking about, how do you talk to your kids about it? You said you really didn't talk to them very much about it until this series. That's kind of interesting.
Yes. And I think the age of the children and what they can tolerate to understand as well has a lot to do with it. But I also think that you teach tolerance through demonstrating and through the way that you live your lives. And I think the more we profess it sometimes and talk about it, the more we create the question and the stereotype in their own minds. And that's where my children go to a predominantly Caucasian white school. However, there is a mix of some diversity. But if you look at the ratio, I think of even in this country, I think it's a fair ratio of a realistic diversity, or mix of people.
But everybody's not going to be part of a reality show to introduce these conversations, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
What kind of conversation? You said it did raise some interesting
questions.
Yes, tell me about that.
My eldest child, Jenna, asked the question of why, Mom, they're interested in us just because we're Muslim. And the answer was yes, because we're living the everyday American grind, you know, of jobs and sports and, you know, trying to juggle work-life balance, trying to have maintain a healthy marriage, relationship, you know, within our families. And so that was my answer to her. And I just kind of stopped and thought about it. And I thought, wow, this isn't really what I wanted my children exposed to. But maybe on the flip side of that, as Des was saying, that's it's good for them to understand because they could eventually face it.
Well, but one of the arguments about the series was one of the criticisms was Pollyanna. And some critics felt that it didn't address enough around the intolerance that some Muslims seem to have for people who are not Muslim or who don't adhere even to a very specific adherence to Islam. I just wanted to ask you, you know, about that. I mean, do you feel any responsibility that you have to, as a Muslim, stand up for tolerance or something?
I personally do not feel that I have to stand up for that. I try to stand up as an American, first of all, because I think your patriotism and your nationality is different than your belief in your faith. So I personally do not feel that I need to stand up for that. I think that the premise of the show was based on being an American Muslim and the nationality of being American as well as the faith of being Muslim.
Desiree?
Yeah, you
final
know,
thought?
By asking that question, you know, your daughter asking a question, why are they interested in us? You do give that reverse message sometime, and that's, I think, where sometimes parents of color really go overboard. You know, the question is, you aren't normal, and so you do have to explain yourself to other people. And that
so
puts the question.
Tell me how you would want to raise it. We have a minute and a half.
All right.
Left,
well,
so
I mean, that puts the question in the child's mind. So I'm not normal. So, you know, it's really about at home, not talking about success and not talking about achievements in terms of color, but in terms of personality, in terms of striving, in terms of family history. Mm-hmm. That's what you arm your children with when they go out. It's not like I want you to be the first black surgeon to do something. I just want you to be a surgeon, you know, because this is what you're about.
And don't forget where you come from.
Right. Okay. Leslie, I'm going to give you the final thought. How will you know that you've succeeded in implanting the kinds of ideas and values in your kids that you want them to have around this specific issue?
Well, I look for how they talk about their friends mostly and how they talk about issues in their lives. And one thing I see as a big sign of success is that within our own little family unit, we have a lot of diversity of opinion, which is an important kind of diversity and is a sign of tolerance. And I guess one point of success here is that I openly said recently that I couldn't believe that Newt Gingrich had married his high school geometry teacher. And I said, I'd never vote for him just because of that. And all three of my kids opposed me and said, well, that's ridiculous. You know, that's pretty cool to marry a teacher. And I said, okay, let's agree to disagree.
All right, very good. Leslie Morgensteiner is one of our regulars. She has three kids. She joined us from our studio in Washington, D.C., here with us at WDET in Detroit. Desiree Cooper, freelance journalist. She writes the blog Detroit Snob and a frequent contributor to WDET, who's hosting us today. She's the mom of two. And Angela Jaffer is the mom of four. Her family was one of those profiled on the All-American Muslim series on TLC. They were both here with us at member station WDET in Detroit. Welcome. Ladies, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Finally, today, as we wrap up this special broadcast from WDET in Detroit, you talk back to us, Detroiters only, please. Just for fun, our hosts here at member station WDET reached out to listeners through various social media channels to tell us, in 25 words or less, what the rest of the country should know about Detroit. We received a ton of responses, and here is a small sample.
Hi, this is Sue Majeski. They call me Suma from the east side of Detroit. The current creative energy in the city of Detroit and its suburbs offers an opportunity of unparalleled excellence. Get involved and see the fabulous ideas taking shape. Come and be a part of it. We'd love to have you.
Thank you, Suma. Another listener, Noah Stevens, is a photographer who shoots portraits of everyday residents of Detroit. He summed up his thoughts in 15 words, saying, quote, "The People of Detroit Portraiture Project proves not everyone in Detroit is an abandoned building," unquote. Noah, we hear you. And staying with the theme, our final comment suggests that we visit some of the most vibrant buildings in Detroit, the theaters.
Hi, this is John Luther, and I am a director and choreographer, and I live in Metro Detroit. So here in 25 words or less, Detroit equals theater. The Fisher, the Masonic, the Opera House, the Gem, Detroit Rep, Mosaic, the Baldwin, the Ringwald, the Century, the Fox, the Music Hall. So, Michelle, next time you're in Detroit, take advantage of our vibrant theater scene. Thanks.
Well, John, I appreciate that, but where are my tickets? If you came to D.C., I would hook you up. So next time I'm in Motown, come correct. And speaking of Motown, what better way to end the program than with a tune straight out of Hitsville, USA, Stevie Wonder's jam from 1966, Uptight. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow. We'll be back at our home base in Washington, D.C.